Welcome, everyone, to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in Northwest Lower Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. During the next half hour, Anne-Marie Oman and I will chat with Debbie Gwartney about her chilling new nonfiction book, Live Through This, A Mother's Memoir of Runaway Daughters. Then Anne-Marie Oman will catch us up on the writing workshop scene this spring, and we will celebrate National Poetry Month with Fleeta Brown and friends. We will open with Deborah Gwartney reading from her new book.
One late autumn night, a few weeks after the freight train dropped her in San Francisco, my 14-year-old daughter Stephanie wandered in the Tenderloin District. It was 1996. She was by herself except for the puppy following her on a rope leash. She had on a tank top worn through and a pair of double-kneed Carhartts that were dirty from the train yard and dirty from the train she'd ridden in. She also wore a stained orange necklace, a string of about 20 pointed teeth she'd pried from the jaws of a dead nutria, a strange cousin of the beaver that tended to get smashed nearly flat on the rails that ran along the Willamette River. High on whatever was smoked and handed out that night in the Tenderloin, and on too many 40-ounce bottles of beer, Stephanie staggered through the clusters of the stoned and the drunk, people who inhabited this corner of the city after dark. The crack cocaine users were out in the public square, a crackhead fair, I'd hear her call it years later. They'd spread ratty blankets on the concrete plaza near the library and lay out broken watches, bottle caps, toys, dropped from tourist baby strollers, parts of toilet paper dispensers stolen from department store bathrooms. Shiny things, she said, as if deposited there by crows. Stephanie stumbled to one of these displays glowing under a streetlight and squatted to the ground to have a look. She reached over to pick up a metal box, thinking that she'd trade the crackhead for the out-of-fuel yellow lighter in her pocket. But the second she lifted the box off the blanket, rolling it from her fingers to her palm, its owner leaped out of the shadows with a Bowie knife in his hand. He yelled at her to get away. He ran toward her, shouting, scattering his stuff as he slipped and slid to get to her. Stephanie dropped the box and was up fast, but the knife was already pointed at her chest. She jumped back as he took a swipe. A line of blood popped up on the inside of her skinny arm, the one she'd raised to protect herself, 4 or 5 straight inches. Stephanie watched the cut drip blood as she turned from him and hurried through the hazy crowd toward her friends, the puppy under her good arm. She made her way to her older sister Amanda, who'd stayed with the group my girls had hooked up with after they'd left our house in Oregon, a group they called Travelers, travelers who followed certain music, punk, grunge, Johnny Cash, and certain weather, sunny days, tolerable nights, and certain drugs, getting from one city to another on rumbling freight trains. You need stitches, one guy said when Stephanie slumped down into the circle of friends who were wrapped in cheap blankets caked with dirt, surrounded by smoke. No way, Stephanie insisted. They'd want my name. And that was that.
Deborah Gwartney is on the nonfiction writing faculty at Portland State University. Her short stories, personal narratives, essays, and articles have appeared in numerous journals, magazines, and newspapers. For 10 years, she worked as a correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She lives in Western Oregon with her husband, writer Barry Lopez, and is the mother of 4 daughters. Deborah is in the area this week to talk to the creative writing students at the Interlochen Arts Academy. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I'm joined in this interview by Anne-Marie Oman, our old friend.
Hello.
Writer, memorist, poet.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
And I'm glad you're here to talk with us. Your new book, which I read yesterday, which just knocked me over, it's such a powerful and moving story. The new book, Live Through This, it's almost like a challenge. Live Through This, A Mother's Memoir of Runaway Daughters and Reclaimed Love.
Yes.
Out this year.
Out this week,
2009.
Yes. What a pleasure to have you here the week it comes out.
What a pleasure to be here.
Could you tell us, or tell our listeners, how you got started on this book and what's it about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I started the book about 8 years ago, actually, and it was in the aftermath of a kind of tremendously hard time in my family where I had been divorced and moved to a new place by myself, Eugene, Oregon, with my four daughters to try to start a new life. And
now the daughters, we have sort of, mm-hmm. I look at it as two groups of daughters. Mm-hmm. We have the early teen daughters, mm-hmm. who are the oldest, mm-hmm. and then we have the young daughters.
The two young daughters, yeah, yes. All the same father, but they were in two sets. Even though they're all 2 years apart, they really form these kind of two sets, the older girls and the younger girls.
And you describe the two older ones as being joined at the hip,
yes,
more or less.
Yes, they were very, very close to each other. And we got to Eugene, and I was working a lot and lots of stress among us as we were trying to figure out how to get going again, and I just became very an embattled situation with my older daughters, and they ended up skipping school a lot and met up with a bunch of kids on the streets there in Eugene, Oregon, and eventually those kids taught them how to jump on freight trains. And so at the ages of 14 and 16, they jumped on a train and pretty much disappeared. The older one came back after 3 months, and the younger one was gone for a year. So the story that I tried to tell was about how did that, you know, happen, and how do I think now in retrospect that happened, and how did we finally find our way back to each other somehow.
Mm-hmm. And you cover, boy, a lot of time. I mean, a lot, mm-hmm. of years go by that mm-hmm. you are struggling with this.
Mm-hmm.
When I finished reading it last night, I was thinking back to Hemingway's lines, a writer's job is to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes through in this book is, and he was talking about fiction, but telling the truth in fiction, you know, making that world out there, telling about that world out there, which you do so beautifully in this book, you know, that this must have been very difficult.
Except this is nonfiction.
This is nonfiction.
Right.
Yeah. And the other line I had from that is tell the truth without screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to scream for you and with you.
Mm. Thanks.
By the time I got to the end of the book.
Yeah.
How were you able to get that distance?
Well, a couple of things. First, I am a huge follower of the of Vivian Gornick's, Sven Burkert's, Philip Lopate, the people who are really writing about what the genre of memoir. And as I was trying to think about how to write my story, I was also reading lots of memoir and thinking about craft issues and style issues. And I really believe in this idea, especially that Gornick comes up with in the situation in the story of her book, that that the I, you know, the capital letter I, mm-hmm. the pronoun, has to be a double strand in a memoir, where there's the narrator who has lived past the experience looking back on the character I who was in the experience. And so as long as I could keep straight, it's a slippery fish, and I had a lot of trouble with it, but I struggled. That's why it took me 8 years to write this book, I think, is because I kept conflating those two eyes. And as long as I could keep them separate and understand I have to be the more distant narrator talking about myself as a younger woman, mm-hmm. dealing with this. And I kind of let the writing solve it. The more I wrote, the more I revised, and the more distance I could see between those two eyes. And I studied with Philip Lopate in graduate school, and he would always say, when the action is hot, write cool, is, you know, kind of something that he would.
That's great.
And so I really took that on, too, and I thought, I challenged myself in a couple ways. No one can cry in the book. I'm not going to go for the easy emotion. I think one of my younger daughters cries once, and that's it. I would not allow the easy kind of emoting that felt a little bit like a cheat. Every time, mm-hmm. I would say to myself, I have to push for the emotion the reader doesn't expect. And another Lopate-ism that I love is to always write against the self, always, you know, dig into contradiction, because contradiction is where the real human experience exists. So that was, those were kind of some of my mantras as I was writing.
I think the I understand perfectly that double I that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I talk about it. It's a little bit, as you gain distance from it, it's a little bit like looking at a double exposure of exactly the same photograph, but just slightly off from each other.
That's wonderful, yes.
So one of the things I think that you do in that telling the truth without screaming and also in that double vision is this very vulnerable character. I'm amazed at the vulnerability of this character. You are so willing to look at yourself in the most difficult light, I think, and do it with such authenticity that we're compelled as readers to stay with you as this mother who's just dying inside looking for her daughters. And I wondered if that was part of the revision process or if that impulse was there right from the beginning.
Oh no! The first kind of barf of this book, you know, I mean, it just kind of blah, you know. It was very long. It was much longer than it is now, and it was all about poor me struggling against these daughters who hurt me, you know. And then it took me a long time to realize that nobody wants to read that book, and you know, another great Gornick-ism from her book is that we must know the loneliness of the monster and the cunning of the innocent. And so, you know, I would really think about that a lot and how can I complicate everybody? And I realized that self-implication was just absolutely key. And, you know, I've already had several people tell me, oh, you blame yourself too much or you beat yourself up too much in this book. And, you know, maybe the pendulum swung a little too far. I'm not sure. But I started with this book, this manuscript that was pretty awful where I was the victim, and it just doesn't, victimhood just does not work in memoirs, and I don't think. And so I tried, what I tried to do is say to myself, we were caught in a dynamic. I played a role in that dynamic. I can't tell my daughter's story. I can only tell my own story. And that really came through for me when we, the girls and I did a piece on This American Life about 5 years ago, where that we told this, each of us told this, our own versions of this time. And we decided to fly to San Francisco. They were living in different places. We decided to meet in San Francisco, kind of a neutral place, and sit in a hotel room and hear it together. So the three of us met there, and we were sitting on the bed of this little hotel room, and we turned on the radio, and, you know, astonishingly, there were our voices. And not 30 seconds after that show began, the two girls just locked eyes, and they did not stop looking at each other through the whole 30 minutes. And it struck me so powerfully. I thought, my gosh, they have a story that's not my story. And I know that sounds almost naive, but to that point, I thought we shared a story. But of course we don't share a story. They have a story that is all their own. And that's the moment that I thought I can go home and write my story and stop trying to tell their story. So that was a hugely pivotal moment for me in the writing of the book.
So when you started writing the book, did you just start with a blank sheet of paper or did you have journals from the time that you went back and refreshed your memory with?
I had a few journals, but I had this one image in my mind, and that was looking for my second daughter, Stephanie, in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco. And I wanted to write that story. I wasn't thinking about a book at this point. I just thought, I want to write about looking for her and what that felt like to be in the Tenderloin District, you know, going through these crowds of people trying to find my 14-year-old daughter. And
which is one of the most powerful sections of the book. Oh. In its final version.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
That's very strong.
Yeah, well, it was an extremely potent moment because I think that's also the moment where I realized a couple things. A, if she didn't want to be found, she wasn't going to be found. You just don't go and say, oh, there you are. You know, she had to want to be found. And then the other thing is that I had to start thinking about the possibility that she might have died. So, you know, those two things kind of come into play there. So that was just this little piece I wrote, and I decided to send it out, and it was published in Creative Nonfiction, a journal. And I got a lot of calls and from other people saying, well, what else are you writing? And then I thought, maybe there's something here. So it kind of got me going.
So as you worked through the drafts, you gained distance?
Definitely, yeah.
And how many drafts and how many years? It's like 8 years?
8 years and at least that many full drafts of this manuscript, yes. It's been hugely revised from the beginning. And even with my wonderful editor from Houghton Mifflin, Deanne Ermey, she's fantastic. But she also went back and said, we need more self-awareness. We need more self-awareness. And, oh, my God, if I'm any more self-aware, I'm going to be Buddha or something. But, but I, you know... She was right. She was absolutely right. And she made me go back and look at these parts where that little bit of victimhood was still seeping through. And
But that's sort of the amazing thing about writing. As you work through something time and time again, you really get to understand it and perhaps even understand yourself as in the process.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the thoughts flash by in our heads. But when you have to sit there and look at it and look at it and look at it.
So true.
I think to some degree when you're writing memoir that deeply and with such a compelling story as you and your daughters have, it seems to me that you also in some way make yourself. I mean, you make an identity, you shape an identity out of that. And it's not merely an identity for the reader. I think there's some risk in it in that you reshape or begin to make at least in to some degree your own identity more malleable.
Oh my
as
gosh.
Well, you know, you
That's
begin
nice.
To shift that by actually putting it out on the page and then having it come back to you through the revision process. And
yes.
I almost felt like that. I could almost see that happening. Your your style is so tight and so transparent that it's right there, and it's almost as though I could see that shaping occurring as you go through these horrendous events with your daughters.
That's so interesting because when my youngest daughter read the book, she came over to my house and said, why didn't you just sit down and tell us these things the way you were feeling? And I said, you know, it wasn't that these were in my conscious mind and I just wrote them down. I just didn't transcribe my thoughts. I had to come to these ideas about myself through the writing, just like you're saying. There was no time that I could just sit down and say them. The writing itself had to bring those to the surface. And I think it confused her still about why those weren't easily little motes that I could pass on. But they
Well, it seemed like you were protecting the two younger girls while trying to work through what was going on with the two older girls. And I can't remember exactly where it was. I think you were on the phone or something, and one of the two younger girl presses you on what happened, and you don't tell her, you know, because you're trying to divide this world out a little bit.
Right. Yeah, and they protected me. I mean, they just really saved my life many times. I had no idea how to get through, and I would just think, well, I've got these two little girls at the other end of the house. I got to get up and take care of them. And it was just, I don't know what would have happened to me without them. They were just so tender and loving the whole time and scared to death. So, yeah, it was quite a time for them.
In the actual, as you move towards the final draft of the book, the craft is so strong. I mean, that's one of the things that Anne-Marie and I both noticed going through it. You know, it's just beautifully done writing. How long did that take?
A long time. I mean, lots of about six of sections in here were published as individual pieces, as standalone essays or memoirs and journals or magazines. And so they were, you know, I revised them a lot for that. And then I had this idea that, oh, you just take all these individual pieces and plunk them down and that makes a book. But I didn't really understand how difficult that arc was going to be to achieve. So I'd say the last 4 years I've done very little but just smooth and smooth and smooth. And yeah, it's been... it was a lot of revision. Mm-hmm. I really wanted, I mean, I'm not going to say that it's a flawless book by any means, but I really wanted every sentence to matter. And so I was trying to work on that level where I would say, do I need this clause or do I need this sentence or have I already said that? And I just wanted it to be spare and direct.
And it is. I mean, at the sentence yes. level, at the paragraph level, there's great economy. There's mm-hmm. there's great power.
Right. And that makes it move very quickly, mm. despite the fact that this is such a difficult story. And always, that first thing that you said about the not having your daughter's story, that they have a story that you don't have, mm-hmm. that their story presses up against your mm-hmm. story in so many ways. And I think that the tension of that absence also keeps the story compelling.
Oh, that's neat. I hadn't thought about that, but I love that.
It just seems to me that that's how mm-hmm. you create a great deal of what moves this story forward mm-hmm. is your literal anxiety, caution, panic, worry, you know, fear, terrible fear about what the story is that you don't know.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. I mean, that was never conscious, but I love it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it reads like a novel. I mean, when yes. we talk mm-hmm. about arc, mm-hmm. The story has a very definite arc. Mm-hmm. And often memorists try to get everything in. Mm-hmm. And what's so fiction writers, novelists, don't. I mean, they stick right. to the arc. They're telling right. a story right. that, you know, you have the characters, you develop them a little bit, you get them in trouble, you resolve the trouble, or you don't resolve the trouble. But, right. you know, there is. But memoir sometimes gets chocked full of things. Mm-hmm. But you have weeded it out. So it's such a clear arc. It's such a clear story. And I think that's what makes it such a compelling read, because the reader is propelled along this course with you. Mm-hmm. And
yes, I'm a big believer in arc. It's the first thing I draw on the whiteboard or whatever that thing's called. When my class comes in, you know, when I'm teaching memoir classes, I draw that arc and I say, you know, we're going to learn how to stick with this, the trajectory of the arc and what it means. It's all about tension. It's not about time. And so I was pretty devoted to doing that. And I also, you know, in my own mind and also with my students, I'm always saying the reader doesn't want to see the whole field of growing corn. There's no way to take it in. It's your job to find the perfect swath to walk us through so we can see what the cornfield looks like down on the ground in great specificity. And then the field makes so much more sense yeah. when you just walk through the swath. It's a kind of a struggling analogy, but it's really worked for me not to try to pull way back and tell it all. There's so many things that were left out of this book. And, you know, my daughters and I asked them to read an early version, a middle version, a late, and then they read the very latest version and the two older ones. And we talked for hours about what was left out and what I had decided to include. And they never said, I want you to put this scene in or that scene in, but they would say, well, the time feels off here. You know, you forgot about this and this. And so we still have some dispute among the three of us about exact chronology, but I just had to go with my own memory in the end.
That's the interesting thing about family history.
Yes, that's right.
There are so many versions of the same story.
It's so true. Yeah.
So as we work on this arc, your daughters are probably close to 30 now, right?
Or yeah, they are 27 and 29. They are.
Mm-hmm. And they went through some very tough times. Mm-hmm. And now they are
just
functioning
hugely
adults.
Successful, thriving young women. They're just, they had the most mellow 20s of anybody I've ever met. I think they got it all out of their system. They're both very successful. The older one is a mom and lives on a farm, and she and her husband raise goats and chickens and live off the grid. They don't have any electricity, so they're really all into this idea of so-called sustainability. They're just living it out. And my second daughter is in school on the East Coast and just doing such marvelous things. Two younger girls are doing great too. We've all done well.
So one of the things that interested me along the way was your frustration with police agencies and therapists, people out there to help, but don't help very much or can't because of the way the law is set up.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the law is so confusing. And in fact, George Bush signed the latest version of the Youth Runaway Act just before he left office. And it started in 1974. I don't think very many people – I didn't know that there was a federal law in 1974 that decriminalized running away. But at that point, the national lawmakers were convinced that if kids ran away from home, it was because they were being abused. And that has been the assumption ever since. Once your child runs away from home, it's automatically assumed that you did something to them to cause that.
And in the book, various counselors sort of approached you with that that assumption that had to be enormously painful.
It was. I mean, mostly in the shelter system because I kept going to the shelters to say, this is a picture of my daughter. Have you seen her? And they would give me absolutely no information. They'd say, we're here to help the kids and they're federally funded. And, my daughters have a real bone of contention with me over this because they said those shelters saved us. They gave us a safe place to sleep and eat. And sure, I want that for kids. But I also think that there needs to be a lot more effort to help the parents because police can't do anything, won't do anything. They just, it's...
Because they're not legally bound to.
They're not legally bound to. Mm. And the funding mostly goes to shelters and to education on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Your youngest of the top, the oldest too.
Right, yeah. Stephanie.
Stephanie found her own way by going to a school called Eagle Rock. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, it was this marvelously serendipitous moment. I was having lunch with a woman and saying, oh my gosh, my daughter, I don't know. She had come back off the streets, but things were terrible between us. And she said, my ex-husband runs this school in Colorado. So I called him that night, and 6 months later, that's where Stephanie was. And it is the most amazing, helpful, innovative, mind-blowing school for teenagers I've ever experienced.
And the teenager has to make application, not
that's
mom
right.
and dad.
Not the system, not the judge. The child has to want to go.
So what do they do that's different?
Well, they start by, when the kids get there, when the class gets there of maybe 20, they give them sleeping bags, tarps, a box of food, and they say, there's the Rocky Mountains. We're going to send you out with this guide. You guys go out there for 3 weeks and get to know each other. So this little class of kids, winter or summer, whenever it is, they go out and they camp for 3 weeks. And the teachers go up and talk to them and have time with them. They do a lot of hiking, and they just push them to the very end of what they can manage physically. And then they run in at the end of 3 weeks, and they're this amazingly bonded group of kids at that point. And the school is about, from then on, it's about two things. You have to be here to build this community, and you have to be here to take responsibility for yourself. And every single thing that you do has to support those two things, or you have to go home.
Mm-hmm.
No one pays tuition there. It's free. So I've been there a couple times when kids have blown it. They get caught smoking a cigarette up and back. They are gone within the hour. Pack your bags, you're out. And so everybody knows that that boundary is absolutely firm. Other than that, they can wear what they want. They can draw what they want. They have all kinds of creative room. But there are certain rules that if you don't serve the community, you can't stay here. They do allow second chance letters. And I mean, it's not permanently out. They have ways for kids to come back. But it's hard work to get back in. Mm-hmm. You have to prove yourself every single day that you belong there and that you're getting something out of it. And I just watch it work like a machine or, this human, alive thing. And it's miraculous. I'm so in such admiration. And Stephanie went there and just bloomed like the rose that she is, to use an old cliche. But it just hit her at the right time. She, everybody plays a musical instrument, so there. So she wanted to play the accordion so she could play like Tom Waits, and, you know, she just got to do her thing.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a great school.
And you're right. It sounds like the timing was right.
She was ready.
Yeah, because she'd been gone so long, mm-hmm. and she knew mm-hmm. how bad it could get.
Yeah.
And yet she knew she had to go her own way.
Yep, she did. She did have to go her own way. She's still going her own way in much healthier ways now. But, you know, when I've asked her about this train jumping past of hers, she says, you know what? I'm sorry it hurt you. I'm sorry it hurt my dad. I'm sorry that everybody was so worried. But it shaped who I am today, and I'm not sorry I did it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where she is.
Wow.
She was a very adventurous girl.
Well, it's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
We are so delighted that you're here. Live Through This, Deborah Gwartney.
That's it.
And if listeners want to get more information, they can go to your website, which is?
DeborahGwartney.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. It's springtime here in northern Michigan. Oh, it's hard to believe, isn't it? Anne Marie's here. This sounds like the beginning of the Canterbury Tales, only we're not going to talk about a pilgrimage. We're going to talk about going off to workshops and retreats, and one of the ones that's going on right here in our own backyard is the 2009 Interlochen Writers Retreat from June 15th through 18th. Anne Marie is the artistic director of that.
I am.
Could you give us just a few minutes on what's going to happen this summer?
Well, it's just such a lovely opportunity. It's of course, this is not the first time we've done it, but this is the first time we've taken this retreat approach. We are really trying to offer people that 4 days of intense study, a place to be generative, to create new work, and also to have some quiet time, some work time to write, to actually be doing the writing. So it's a nice balance of workshop time where you're in a group with people of like-minded folks with a fabulous instructors, and you also have some quiet time. We've balanced the time so that you can actually do the practice, enter the practice of the writing and apply some of the things you're learning in the workshop. So it has that retreat format.
And you will be teaching memoir.
I am.
And the two other instructors?
Oh, I am so excited about these people. Jack Riddle, of course, many people will be familiar with his name. He's one of our most profoundly important state poets. He is now retired from Hope, and so he's doing more of this kind of work, and we were
retired
just,
from Hope College.
Hope College, I'm sorry. Yes, not retired from Hope. Oh dear. And he is coming to do the poetry workshop, and I'm just really excited. I'm so thrilled with having him come back. And this year we have Patty McNair, who's coming up from Columbia College, Chicago. And she is one of the most dynamic fiction instructors I've encountered in a long time. And I don't say that lightly, because I've had the privilege of observing many fine fiction instructors. But she has this energy and this focus and this understanding of structure and this way of teaching, which makes it very accessible. And I'm also thrilled to have her come.
Okay, so if people want information, the best way to get it is?
They should Google the 2009 Interlochen Writers Retreat, and it'll pop up. It is the summer part of the summer programming for the College of Creative Arts. And also, I want to say that there is a discount for Michigan Writers members, and that's through a grant that we have received that allows Michigan Writers members to get this discount. And that's a first come, first serve basis.
Great. We are looking forward to this event. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
April is National Poetry Month, a celebration of poetry and poets in America. As our part in the celebration on Michigan Writers Radio, it is my pleasure to welcome three poets plus someone doing a cameo appearance. First of all, Fleeta Brown. Welcome, Fleeta.
Thank you.
Fleeta is the former Poet Laureate of Delaware and has six volumes of poetry and is a regular contributor to this program. We have Anne Marie Oman. Welcome, Anne Marie.
Thank you.
Poet, memorist, and playwright. And Jenny Robertson, one of the winners of the 2009 Michigan Writers Cooperative Press competition, who has her first book out now, Hard Winter, First Thaw.
Yeah,
well,
thanks.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And to all of our surprise, we have Doug Stanton, well-known writer in the area, who through Interlochen Undergraduate School and Graduate School was a poet,
mm-hmm.
and then became a prose writer. As I was preparing for this program, I was chatting with Fleeta about how we might best celebrate National Poetry Month, and she suggested we talk about poetry and prose and their differences.
I was thinking of that because I don't know a better way to talk about poetry than to kind of put it up beside something else. And so I thought, okay, let's do that.
And she proposed a series of questions that
my fault.
So we throw out to the poets here gathered. The first one being, what makes you turn to poetry instead of prose, and when do you make that decision, or how do you make that decision?
I guess since it's my question, I talk first.
Okay.
I am quite, well, poetry seems to be my baseline genre. It seems to be the one I turn to. I was actually today, this was very clear to me because I was writing about a poem, and I realized that the poem has this. Actually, what I was doing is I was writing a blurb for somebody's book, and I realized that her poems, what they do is they give me a kind of sense of breathlessness. There's a kind of lifting off, ecstatic moment, and that's what I was saying in the blurb. But I was thinking this is why I turn to poetry. This is what it is in poetry that catches me first. And when I'm writing prose, it's because what I want to do is probably if you touched an electrode to different parts of my brain, you'd find that a different part of my brain was lighting up when I do prose. And it's a more, it's a more contemplative part of my brain. It's the part that wants to sort of figure things out.
Hmm. So have you always written essays, or is this a relatively new part of your writing career?
Well, I used to write essays at the demand of many teachers.
Well, we all did that.
Yes.
But, I mean, once we got to that point in life when we didn't have to
do
that.
No, I've always written essays, but of various sorts, and it's only been in the last 6 or 7 years that I've been putting together these memoir essays, and from here I'm quite sure I'm about ready to plunge into a new essay phase. Because I've done what I want to do with poems for a little while. It doesn't mean I won't write any. It just means that my mind is beginning to sort of turn in that direction right
now.
Mm-hmm.
So, Anne-Marie, you poet and playwright probably first and prose writer later,
mm-hmm.
But your prose writing has been sensational, and you've done very well with it.
I think you were going to say successful.
No, I was going to say sensational.
I always feel like I sort of stumbled into prose, and that's how people usually know me. But the poetry and plays were there from the beginning. Yeah. It's a similar thing to what Fleeta was saying. I find the difference between poetry and prose for me is more a matter of degree. They're sort of on this long spectrum, 1 to 100 or something like that. But for me, the impulse toward poetry is a sense of mystery, and the impulse toward prose is a sense of action. I'm trying, and when I want to write poetry, the subject is something that seems mysterious to me. It has unspoken things in it, and there's this intangible quality that starts to really generate stuff in my imagination that is in that direction. And for prose, it's more wanting to understand an action. It's wanting to understand something that's happened. It tends, especially with plays, it tends to be action-based, and there's an incident at the center of it, or a shift or a transformation in that's actually external on some level, or at least even if it's metaphorical, it has some external sort of implementation. And so even though those are all matters of degree, you can have a lot of action in a poem, and you can certainly have that mystery in prose. That's where it starts for me. Okay. That's how it begins.
And Jenny, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
People sitting around this table have been publishing for many of them for many, many years, and you've just started publishing,
yes.
but your career is very similar to most of ours in that there was school and college and then lots of years and then publication.
Right.
So you've been writing for a long time. It's not as if you're new to writing, and you've been thinking about these issues for a long time, I'm sure.
Yes, and it's great to be sitting at this table with all of you, actually. But yeah, I actually hadn't thought too much about what turned me to poetry and what turned me to prose until I found that 4 years ago when I became a mother that I actually could not write poetry for a few years. And I just found that writing poetry required kind of a mental clarity and freedom that I suddenly didn't have. I think motherhood kind of spun my brain, and part of me was always focused on my daughter and her needs. And fiction suddenly was more suited to my new reality. I could sit down for a half an hour in the morning, reread what I'd written the day before, and that was enough that I could just start in. And poetry for me requires so much emotion, thought, and music to be brought tightly together and kind of receptive emptiness that I didn't have. It's only in the past year since my daughter has grown up a bit and is more independent that I've noticed that bits of poetry are coming back into my brain, and I'm happy to know that it hasn't forsaken me completely.
It's interesting that you say that, because I have a dear friend in Philadelphia who's been writing poems for years who said that the reason she started writing poems is that they are short, and her kids, you know, would pull her away, and she could stick with a poem until it was finished, but she couldn't stick with something else.
Oh, that's
until
funny.
It was finished.
That's really funny.
And Doug, you were trained as a poet, but you've spent your adult life as a prose writer.
Many happy hours at Interlochen in the poetry workshop and then in graduate school. I think, you know, but I remember, though, at a certain point, maybe I said I want to write something. I was in at University of Iowa, and there were a lot of people in language poetry, right, Fleeta's rolling her eyes. And I wrote an incomprehensible poem that was just so incomprehensible that I didn't even know what it meant. And I had to go to my teacher, Jory Graham, and she told me what it meant. And it actually made lots of sense, and I was working on all these different kinds of metaphorical and imagistic levels. But then I decided I wanted to write something that my great-grandmother could understand. So, I don't know, I switched to prose. But, you know, if you read the opening of All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy, mm-hmm. or if you read the prose poems by James Wright into A Blossoming Pear Tree, those prose poems by Wright are actually sonnets or villanelles that have just been the lines have been broken into prose. And so at some level, I don't think there is a difference, except as someone used to say, poetry may be the purest form of speech. I wrote one the other day when I was cleaning the garage because I had time, and it was a very, you know, I sat down, I was cleaning, and I was thinking about a lot of bad stuff in the news, and I got rid of this image, and I kind of divested myself of this feeling. And the poem did that. Prose couldn't do that for me.
Well, this really speaks to the next question that Fleeta generated for us to think about. What's the difference in poetry and prose in what it wants to accomplish?
And actually, the operative word there for me is wants, because there isn't a lot of difference between poetry and prose. There's no way any of us are going to be able to. There are some poems that are clearly poems, and you know that instantly because of what it's doing. And there are prose that's clearly prose, and you know that because it seems to have a kind of utilitarian purpose or something. But all of the prose and poems in between I think that the word intention, the word purpose is really, if I say it's a poem, then, you know, in some sense, it's a poem. It may not be a good poem, but if I say it's a poem, mm-hmm. then, you know, it may come out to the end of the line. It may not come out to the end of the line. It may use some traditional techniques, some traditional forms, and it may not, so, you know, in the kind of a basic sense, I suppose there's not any difference, but that's kind of quick and, you know, a little bit glib to say that, because there is something intrinsic in poetry and prose. I think that poetry leans more toward wanting to be with the language as it's being spoken. You know, there's something in poetry that's always pulling us back into the poem and into the language. And one of the reasons lines stop before they reach the end is that it's sort of drawing us back into a center. And prose, on the other hand, tends to push us forward just by its very structure. But then we can talk later about this strange thing called a prose poem, I guess.
So do they? Can you look at it in terms of what it demands of the reader?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you can.
Should I withdraw my question?
No. I think it's a great question. I was wondering, somebody else would like to answer that question.
I think poetry demands different things of the reader from what prose does, and I think...
And does the poet or the writer have to hold those things in their brain as they're producing that?
To a degree, yes. I mean, I think, you know, there's a whole, again, there's no pure answer to that. There's a whole range of reasons why we write something in a poetic form, and I think there's that sensibility of again, this needs to be a poem and this is prose, but there's also, so you're writing for yourself always initially. I think you're writing to figure that thing out, or that's part of what you're figuring out. And then there's also this contract you have with the reader, which I think Doug was getting at, in that they're to me, although I am writing to say something which I hope is important, I also have a contract to make it accessible. And I think sometimes when we move into those realms, you know, we refer to them as the language poets, and they have other names as well. But you know, they're that contract with the reader is distorted in some way. And for me, although ultimately I start with my own impulse, it's about having somebody else, another human being, pick it up and have something from that language. You know, it's this vehicle for communication that gets close to reflecting our souls. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the primary impulse there. And again, it's a matter for the poetry prose question. I think it's again a matter of degree. As you've both pointed out, passages in prose that you could lift and shape, and the line breaks, the rhythms, the music, the lyricism, it's the craft of a poem is in the prose. It just doesn't have the lines, and vice versa. There are beautiful, beautiful things that are crafted into poetry that feel like you're reading the novel. Mm-hmm. And so it's sometimes what's the way it's shaped on the page. Sometimes it's the way it's sounding. Sometimes it's the exuberance of diction. It's all these crafts, I think, elements of craft mm-hmm. that start to distinguish it, but they're pretty much artificial.
A couple of years ago, we had a poet on the show, and I asked him how he decided when it was a prose poem and when it was a short or something else. And his answer was, when you find an editor who wants to buy it, it is whatever they want it to
be. Yeah.
Well, you know, on the practical level, that certainly applies.
Mm-hmm. I've taken poems and turned them into prose poems and turned them back into poems and back into prose poems several times, just trying to see what it wants to do. And it really is a matter of what the material needs to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. Usually, I think that's the issue. It's not so much what I what I have in mind that the that it ought to do. It's what the material itself wants to do. And I ended up writing a long prose poem series, and I thought I was kind of opposed to prose poems, but I couldn't help it because that the material that I had wanted to be that.
Mm-hmm. And I've had poems, most of them with a narrative element in them that became essays. Mm-hmm. And there are two or three of them in the last book that were originally poems that were actually as poems felt and became outlines for the essay.
Mm-hmm. So the demand for the idea or what you're trying to convey then forces the genre in a way.
Yeah, I think as you work with it, as you delve into it and live in that world, it starts to lead you. Yeah, mm-hmm. There are elements and conventions that start to press on you, and you know, oh, this feels like it ought to go here, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd be curious to know whether you, Jenny, when you're writing your stories, if there were poems that came out of that, or if there were poems that followed from the stories.
It's interesting. I think the stories that were in the chapbook themselves were pretty isolated. I think when I first started, they started as just germs of ideas. And at that point, maybe they could have become poems. But I already had a sense of a lot of characters and some movement that I needed to have happen. And they were both clearly more stories. I don't think I felt I could take care of them in a small space. But I have noticed that I've been writing a lot of essays, personal essays recently that I assumed would stay personal essays, but after leaving them alone for a while, I've looked more closely and I think they actually would be more effective. And I would say more clearly what I was trying to say if I compacted them and made them into poems. So I'm kind of working on that right now.
So you write poetry and prose, but you're also a painter. We can
yes.
even push this farther. You have so many ways of expressing yourself artistically. How do you choose?
It's interesting. I've thought about this a lot in terms of also because of parenthood. I just have very small pieces of free time. Mm-hmm. I find when I actually need to express myself, I go to writing, or if something's bugging me and I haven't been able to name it or put my finger on something, I have to go and write. But if I actually have been doing too much thinking or too much action and I just need to focus, I go paint, because I primarily paint outside, just plein air, where you just work for 2 hours while the light stays the same and mm-hmm. take your best shot. And there's just no way to sit and think about that. You have to just dig into it and pay attention. And mm-hmm. it's a different kind of paying
stay
attention.
Stay in the moment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a ritualistic element in poetry, I think. And by that, I mean that We devise rituals to focus us, and mm-hmm. There's no other form, there's no other genre that has as much ritual as a poem does. Sometimes it has the ritual of a meter. Sometimes it has the ritual of rhyme. It often, you know, there may be it may follow a traditional form, which is another part of the ritual. But if it has none of those things, it's still has a form that you look at and you say, this is this smaller form. It's holding, even if it's an epic poem, it's still holding me in this space, which becomes, because it's so condensed, a ritual space. And so if I had to say something by way of definition, I would say that it heightens language to the level of ritual, that it brings it. It heightens. And when I started talking about poems, I used the word ecstatic. That ecstatic. It brings you to the point of the same kind of sort of breaking up of the linear world into a moment, mm-hmm. which is the goal of ritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting talking about the compressed and compacted thing, because when I was thinking about that, I just thought, usually historically through my life, I've come to poetry when either positively or negatively I felt very strongly, and it seemed like the strength of those feelings or the ideas I wanted to express really need to be taken out of a pressure cooker, looked at closely, and then put back into a compressed space to give the feeling of what I was feeling originally. And it seems like if I unpacked it too much, it would just spread out too much. So it seems like a matter of degree of, you know, intensity that starts the poem.
I'm always surprised when I talk to people how many people will tell me that they're poets. And the vast majority of them have never published anything.
Hmm. That's interesting.
But it's something that they do for themselves that's so incredibly important. So we keep hearing that we do not live in a poetic age, and yet for so many people, personal poetry is an important part of their life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I just, when I was poet laureate in Delaware, there were just people constantly coming up to me saying, you know, they'd sort of come to the side as if this were a secret they wanted to tell me, and they would say, you know, I write poetry. And I respect that. I'm not saying that by way of being making a kind of snide comment. I respect that a great deal. I think what that means is that we all have the impetus toward that kind of celebration, that kind of ritual of the language. And some people as is true of music, art, everything else, some people are talented and study the techniques and get better at it, and other people just write it, which is fine and extremely you know, all of us are just writing it, and we, you know, hope for the best. And sometimes we fall on our faces.
And probably the important thing is that we do it. And if you get an audience, too, that's nice. Thank you all for being here, and happy Poetry Month.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this month on Michigan Writers. I want to thank our guests on today's program, Debbie Gwardney, Amory Oman, Fleeta Brown, Doug Stanton, and Jenny Robertson. I invite you to check out the Michigan Writers website at www.mishwriters.org for an update on lists and activities. My gratitude to our production crew here at IPR, Peter, Jack, Brock, and Brad. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on IPR News Radio 91.5. The show airs the fourth Friday of the month at 7 p.m., repeating on Sunday at 1 p.m. Until then, we wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.